This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents The History of Jazz, Second Edition, written by Ted Gioia, narrated by Bob Sauer. For My Wife Tara. Chapter 1. The Prehistory of Jazz. The Africanization of American Music. An elderly black man sits astride a large cylindrical drum. Using his fingers and the edge of his hand, he jabs repeatedly at the drumhead, which is around a foot in diameter and probably made from an animal skin, evoking a throbbing pulsation with rapid, sharp strokes. A second drummer, holding his instrument between his knees, joins in, playing with the same staccato attack. A third black man, seated on the ground, plucks at a stringed instrument, the body of which is roughly fashioned from a calabash. Another calabash has been made into a drum, and a woman beats at it with two short sticks. One voice, then other voices, join in. A dance of seeming contradictions accompanies this musical give and take, a moving hieroglyph that appears, on the one hand, informal and spontaneous, yet, on closer inspection, ritualized and precise. It is a dance of massive proportions. A dense crowd of dark bodies forms into circular groups, perhaps 500 or 600 individuals moving in time to the pulsations of the music, some swaying gently, others aggressively stomping their feet. A number of women in the group begin chanting. The scene could be Africa. In fact, it is 19th century New Orleans. Scattered first-hand accounts provide us with tantalizing details of the slave dances that took place in the open area then known as Congo Square. Today, Louis Armstrong Park stands on roughly the same ground, and there are perhaps no more intriguing documents in the history of African-American music. Benjamin Latrobe, the noted architect, witnessed one of these collective dances on February 21, 1819, and not only left us with a vivid written account of the event, but made several sketches of the instruments used. These drawings confirm that the musicians of Congo Square, circa 1819, were playing percussion and stringed instruments virtually identical to those characteristic of indigenous African music. Later documents add to our knowledge of the public slave dances in New Orleans, but still leave us with many open questions, some of which, in time, historical research may be able to elucidate, while others might never be answered. One thing, however, is clear. Although we are inclined these days to view the intersection of black and white musical currents as a theoretical, almost symbolic issue, these storied accounts of the Congo Square dances provide us with a real time and place, an actual transfer of totally African ritual to the native soil of the New World. Congo Square may have looked like it was nothing but a party, music historian Ned Sublette has written, but to play a hand drum in 1819 in the United States, where overt manifestations of Africanness had elsewhere been so thoroughly, deliberately erased, was a tremendous act of will, memory, and resistance. The dances in Congo Square were a nexus where opposites collided. The ingrained Western division between performer and audience was eradicated, a distinction so fundamental to us, but of such little importance in traditional African cultures. The separation of song from dance, also pervasive among Western thinkers who deal with the arts, was equally nullified, replaced with a more intrinsically African congruence of sound and movement. These gatherings, a mixture of the ceremonial and social, further broke down barriers between secular and spiritual impulses. A first-hand account from 1808 even uses the word worship to describe them. The dances themselves, marked by clusters of individuals moving in a circular pattern, the largest less than 10 feet in diameter, harken back to one of the most pervasive ritual ceremonies of Africa. This rotating, counterclockwise movement has been noted by ethnographers under many guises in various parts of the continent. In the Americas, the dance became known as the ring shout, a ritual that, in the words of scholar Sterling Stuckey, served as the main content in which Africans recognized values common to them. the appearance of this African carryover in New Orleans is only one of many documented instances in the New World. This tradition persisted well into the 20th century. John and Alan Lomax recorded a ring shout in Louisiana for the Library of Congress in 1934 and attended others in Texas, Georgia, and the Bahamas. As late as the 1950s, jazz scholar Marshall Stearns witnessed unmistakable examples of the ring shout in South Carolina. The Congo Square dances were hardly so long-lived. Traditional accounts indicate that they continued, except for an interruption during the Civil War, until around 1885. Such a chronology implies that their disappearance almost coincided with the emergence of the first jazz bands in New Orleans. More recent research argues convincingly for an earlier cutoff date for the practice, probably before 1870, although the dances may have continued for some time in private settings. But even after the public gatherings came to halt, the tradition of the ring shout lived on in many ways. Samuel Floyd has gone so far as to contend that the ring later straightened itself to become the second line of jazz funerals. Here, he writes, the movements of the participants were identical to those of the participants in the ring, even to the point of the individual counterclockwise movements by second-line participants. Only the ring itself was missing, since the participants had a set destination and needed to direct their movements back to town from the cemetery. Above all, this transplanted African ritual loomed large in the collective memory and oral history of the city's black community, even among those too young to have participated in it. These memories shaped in turn the jazz performer's self-image, their sense of what it meant to be an African-American musician. "My grandfather, that's about the furthest I can remember back," wrote the renowned New Orleans reed player Sidney Bechet in his autobiography, Treat It Gentle. Sundays when the slaves would meet, that was their free day, he beat out rhythms on the drums at the square, Congo Square they called it. He was a musician. No one had to explain notes or feeling or rhythm to him. It was all there inside him, something he was always sure of. Within eyesight of Congo Square, Buddy Bolden, who legend and scattered first-person accounts credit as the earliest jazz musician, performed with his pioneering band at Globe Hall. The geographical proximity is misleading. The cultural gap between these two types of music is dauntingly wide. By the time Bolden and Bechet began playing jazz, the Americanization of African music had already begun, and with it came the Africanization of American music, a synergistic process that we will study repeatedly and at close quarters in the pages that follow. Anthropologists call this process syncretism, the blending together of cultural elements that previously existed separately. This dynamic, so essential to the history of jazz, remains powerful even in the present day, when African-American styles of performance blend seamlessly with other musics of other cultures, European, Asian, Latin, and, coming full circle, African. The mixture of African and European culture began, of course, long before the slave dances in Congo Square, in fact at least 1,000 years prior to the founding of New Orleans in 1718. The question of African influence on ancient Western culture has become a matter of heated debate in recent years, with much of the dispute centering on arcane methodological and theoretical issues. But once again, careful students of history need not rely on abstract analysis to discover early cultural mergings of African and European currents. The North African conquest of the Iberian Peninsula in the 8th century left a tangible impact on Europe, evident even today in the distinctive qualities of Spanish architecture, painting, and music. Had not Charles Martel repelled the Moorish forces in the south of France at the Battle of Tours in 732 AD, this stylized cultural syncretism might have become a pan-European force, if not for the genius and fortune of this one man, historian Gibbon would later declare in The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, the Moorish fleet might have sailed without a naval combat into the mouth of the Thames, and the Quran would now be taught in the schools of Oxford. As it turned out, the spread of African currents into the broader streams of Western culture took far longer to unfold, spurred in large part by defeat rather than conquest, not by triumphant naval fleets toppling the continental powers, but by the dismal commerce of slave ships headed for the New World. Yet the traces of the early Moorish incursion may have laid the groundwork for the blossoming of African-American jazz more than a millennium later. Can it be mere coincidence that this same commingling of Spanish, French, and African influences was present in New Orleans at the birth of jazz? Perhaps because of this marked Moorish legacy, Latin cultures have always seemed receptive to fresh influences from Africa. Indeed, in the area of music alone, the number of successful African and Latin hybrids, including salsa, calypso, samba, tango, and cumbia, to name only a few, is so great that one can only speculate that these two cultures retain a residual magnetic attraction, a lingering affinity due to this original cross-fertilization. Perhaps this convoluted chapter of Western history also provides us with a key for unlocking that enigmatic claim by Jelly Roll Morton, the pioneering New Orleans jazz musician who asserted, "If you can't manage to put tinges of Spanish in your tunes, you will never be able to get the right seasoning, I call it, for jazz." The Latin tinge was already a long-established fact of New Orleans music well before the arrival of jazz on the scene, perhaps not surprising for a city that was still only about 1/8 Anglo-American in the years following the Louisiana Purchase. Around the time of Morton's birth, a massive Mexican cavalry band performed daily in free concerts at the Mexican Pavilion as part of the 1884-85 World's Cotton Centennial Exposition in New Orleans. A little-known and undated work titled Los Campanillas by black New Orleans composer Basile Barres, 1845-1902, effectively employs a Cuban habanera rhythm long before W.C. Handy relied on it to make St. Louis Blues into a hit, or Morton himself adopted it for his composition, The Crave. Even earlier, Louis Moreau Gottschalk enjoyed a transatlantic success with his composition Bambula. As these examples attest, the tinge entered the parlors of the city's many amateur pianists long before the appearance of jazz music. Responding to this demand, Hart's Music Store on Canal Street published over 80 Mexican compositions during the late 19th century, influencing local instrumentalists and providing one more link in the complex history of interlocking Latin and African-American musical styles. Beyond its purely musicological impact, the Latin Catholic culture, whose influence permeated 19th century New Orleans, benignly fostered the development of jazz music. This culture, which bore its own scars of discrimination, was far more tolerant in accepting unorthodox social hybrids than the English Protestant ethos that prevailed in other parts of the New World. Under Spanish law, slaves could be set free without official permission, could own property, and had the right of coartación, which allowed them to purchase their own freedom based on an adjudicated contract. This comparatively less rigid atmosphere helped shape attitudes and behavior patterns in New Orleans. Indeed, it is hard to imagine the dances of Congo Square taking place in the more anglicized colonies of the Americas. Less than half a century after the city's founding in 1764, New Orleans was ceded by France to Spain. In 1800, Napoleon succeeded in forcing its return from Spain, but this renewed French control lasted only 3 years before possession passed to the United States as part of the Louisiana Purchase. As a result, French and Spanish settlers played a decisive role in shaping the distinctive ambience of New Orleans during the early 19th century, yet immigrants from Germany, Italy, England, Ireland, and Scotland also made substantial contributions to the local culture. The city's black inhabitants were equally diverse. Many had been transported directly from various parts of Africa, especially from Senegambia in the early years of French settlement. Some were native-born Americans. Still others came to the United States via the Caribbean. Civil unrest in Hispaniola was especially influential in bringing new immigrants, both black and white, to New Orleans. In 1808 alone, as many as 6,000 refugees fleeing the Haitian Revolution arrived in the city after being forced to leave Cuba. The resulting amalgam, an unprecedented mixture of European, Caribbean, African, and American elements, made Louisiana into perhaps the most seething ethnic melting pot that the 19th century world could produce. This cultural gumbo would serve as breeding ground for many of the great hybrid musics of modern times, not just jazz, but also Cajun, zydeco, blues, and other new styles flourished as a result of this laissez-faire environment. In New Orleans' warm, moist atmosphere, sharp delineations between groups and customs gradually softened and ultimately gave way. Today, the city's residents of Irish descent celebrate St. Patrick's Day by parading in a second line of their own. At Mardi Gras time, black celebrants still dress up as Native Americans, sometimes adopting costumes that cost thousands of dollars, a practice that dates back to the 19th century. Consider as well the distinctive culinary arts of the region with their creative mixture of French, Spanish, African, Choctaw, German, and other traditions. Locals here are hardly surprised by fluid rituals that refuse to be limited by racial or ethnic categories. Indeed, the masquerades of Mardi Gras are a fitting symbol for this city, where the most familiar cultural artifacts appear in the strangest garb. Yet the decisive creative currents in this society came from the African-American underclass. Should this surprise us? The reputation of musicians and other performing artists as outsiders or pariahs, as practitioners who exist at the limits of the socially acceptable, has a long tradition dating back to ancient times. Just a few decades ago, many cultures still retained religious prohibitions asserting the uncleanliness of believers eating at the same table as musicians. And long before music became a consumer product, one more form of idle entertainment for the masses, it was the domain of mystics and magicians, the excluded and ostracized. The story of jazz moving into the center of society from a starting point at the fringes is but one more chapter in this ongoing saga. Even so, the role of slave labor in the production of African-American song makes for an especially sad interlude in this melancholy history. The presence of Africans in the New World, the first documented instance of which occurred in Jamestown in 1619, predated the arrival of the Pilgrims by 1 year. By 1807, some 400,000 native-born Africans had been brought to America, most of them transported from West Africa. Forcibly taken away from their homeland, deprived of their freedom, and torn from the social fabric that had given structure to their lives, these unwilling immigrants clung with even greater fervor to those elements of their culture that they could carry with them. Music and folk tales were among the most resilient of these. Even after family, home, and possessions were taken away, they remained. In this context, the decision of the New Orleans City Council in 1817 to establish an official site for slave dances stands out as an exemplary degree of tolerance. In other locales, African elements in the slaves' music were discouraged or explicitly suppressed. During the Stono Rebellion of 1739, drums had been used to signal an attack on the white population. Anxious to prevent further uprisings, South Carolina banned any use of drums by slaves. The Georgia Code went even further in prohibiting not only drums, but also horns or other loud instruments. Religious organizations assisted in the efforts to control the African elements of the slaves' music. The hymns and spiritual songs of Dr. Isaac Watts, published in various colonial editions beginning in the early 1700s, was frequently used as a way of converting African Americans through more edifying examples of Western music. We are fortunate that these attempts bore little success. Indeed, in many cases, the reverse of the intended effect took place. European idioms were transformed and enriched by the African tradition onto which they were grafted. Alan Lomax, the pioneering scholar and preserver of African-American music, writes, "Blacks had Africanized the Psalms to such an extent that many observers described black lining hymns as a mysterious African music. In the first place, they so prolonged and quavered the texts of the hymns that only a recording angel could make out what was being sung. Instead of performing in an individualized sort of unison or heterophony, however, they blended their voices in great unified streams of tone. there emerged a remarkable kind of harmony in which every singer was performing variations on the melody at his or her pitch, yet all these ornaments contributed to a polyphony of many ever-changing strands, surging together like seaweed swinging with the waves, or a leafy tree responding to a strong wind. Experts have tried and failed to transcribe this river-like style of polyphony. It rises from a group in which all singers can improvise together, each one contributing something personal to an ongoing collective effect, a practice common in African and African-American tradition. The outcome is music as powerful and original as jazz, but profoundly melancholy, for it was sung into being by hard-pressed people. This ability of African performance arts to transform the European tradition of composition while assimilating some of its elements is perhaps the most striking and powerful evolutionary force in the history of modern music. The genres of music that bear the marks of this influence are legion. Let's name a few: gospel, spirituals, soul, rap, minstrel songs, Broadway musicals, ragtime, jazz, blues, R&B, rock, samba, reggae, funk, salsa, calypso, even some contemporary operatic and symphonic music. The history of jazz is closely intertwined with many of these other hybrid genres, and tracing the various genealogies can prove dauntingly complex. For example, minstrel shows, which developed in the decades before the Civil War, found white performers in blackface mimicking and, most often ridiculing, the music, dance, and culture of the slave population. Frequently, the writer of minstrel songs worked with little actual knowledge of Southern black music. A surprising number of these composers hailed from the Northeast, and the most celebrated writer of minstrel-inflected songs, Stephen Foster, created a powerful romanticized image of Southern folklife, despite the most limited first-hand contact. His travels in the Deep South were restricted to a single trip down the Mississippi to New Orleans. Later generations of black entertainers, influenced by the popularity of these second-hand evocations of their own culture, imitated in turn the white stereotypes of African-American behavior. Thus, in its impact on early jazz, minstrel music presents a rather convoluted lineage. A black imitation of a white caricature of black music exerts its influence on another hybrid form of African and European music. The work song, another frequently cited predecessor to jazz, is more purely African in nature, so much so that some examples recorded in the southern United States in the last century show almost no European or American influence. Here, for once, brute economics serve to preserve rather than eradicate African traditions, with even the most callous overseers encouraging music making when it contributed to the productivity of the laborer. This ritualized vocalizing of black American workers, with its proud disregard for Western systems of notation and scales, came in many variants. Field hollers, levee camp hollers, prison work songs, street cries, and the like. This entire category of singing has all but disappeared in our day, yet the few surviving recordings documenting this time-honored tradition reveal a powerful, evocative, and comparatively undiluted form of African music in the Americas. Generalizations about African music are tricky at best. Many commentators have treated the culture of West Africa as though it were a homogeneous and unified body of practices. In fact, many different elements contribute to the traditions of West Africa. Even so, a few shared characteristics stand out amid this plurality in any study of African music, with many of these same ingredients reappearing in a somewhat different guise in jazz. For example, call and response forms that predominate in African music figure as well in the work song, the blues, jazz, and other Americanized strains of African music. Yet, in its original African form, call and response is as much a matter of social integration as a method of performing music. It reflects a culture in which the fundamental Western separation of audience from artists is transcended. This brings us to a second unifying element of African musical traditions, the integration of performance into the social fabric. In this light, African music takes on an aura of functionality, one that defies any pure aesthetic attempting to separate art from social needs. Yet, since these functions are often tied to rituals and other liminal experiences, music never falls into the mundane type of functionality, background music in the dentist's office, accompaniment to a television commercial, and so on, that one sees increasingly in the West. Integrated into ritual occasions, music retains its otherworldliness for the African, its ability to rise above the here and now. The cross-fertilization between music and dance is a third unifying theme in traditional African cultures, so deeply ingrained that scholar John Miller Chernoff remarks that, for an African, understanding a certain type of music means, in its most fundamental sense, knowing what dance it accompanies. A fourth predominant feature of African music is the focus on sounds in instances where Western composers would rely on notes. One of the results of this profound shift in perspective is the use of instruments to emulate the subtle modulations of the human voice. This technique, which also plays a key role in early jazz music, even extends to percussion instruments, most notably in the kalungu, the remarkable talking drum of West Africa. An emphasis on improvisation and spontaneity is a further shared trait of different African musical cultures, and these too have figured prominently in, and to some extent have come to define, the later jazz tradition. However, the most distinctive characteristic, the core element of African music, is its extraordinary richness of rhythmic content. It is here one discovers the essence of the African musical heritage, as well as the key to unlocking the mystery of its tremendous influence on so many disparate schools of 20th century music. The first Western scholars who attempted to come to grips with its rhythmic vitality, whether in its African or Americanized form, struggled merely to find a vocabulary and notational method to encompass it. Henry Edward Krehbiel, author of an early study of African-American folk songs, conveys the frustration of these endeavors in describing the African musicians he encountered at the World's Columbian Exposition held in Chicago in 1893. "The players showed the most remarkable rhythmical sense and skill that ever came under my notice. Berlioz, in his supremest effort with his army of drummers, produced nothing to compare in artistic interest with the harmonious drumming of these savages. The fundamental effect was a combination of double and triple time, the former kept by the singers, the latter by the drummers. But it is impossible to convey the idea of the wealth of detail achieved by the drummers by means of the exchange of the rhythms, syncopations, or both simultaneously, and dynamic devices." Krehbiel engaged the services of John Comfort Fillmore, an expert in Native American music, in an attempt to notate the playing of these musicians, but eventually they gave up in despair. "I was forced to the conclusion," Krehbiel later recalled, in an account in which irritation and awe are present in equal doses, "that in their command of the rhythmic element, which in the musical art of the ancient Greeks stood higher than either melody or harmony, the best composers of today were the veriest tyros compared with these black savages." The vocabularies of certain Eskimo tribes, we are told, possess dozens of words for snow. Where other cultures see only an undifferentiated substance, they perceive subtle differences and a plethora of significations. Similarly, for the African, virtually every object of day-to-day life could be a source of rhythm, an instrument of percussion, and an inspiration for the dance. The tools and implements with which the Africans subdued the often hostile surrounding environment may well have been the first sources of instrumental music on our planet. Here we perhaps come to realize the hidden truth in the double meaning of the word instrument, which signifies both a mechanism for altering the natural world and a device for creating sound. We begin with a given: shells, flints, animal hides, trees, stones, sticks, and we end up with a dazzling array of instruments, both implements used in day-to-day life, weapons, tools, wheels, building devices, and in music-making: drums, rattles, scrapers, gongs, clappers, friction instruments, percussion boards, and the like. But even earlier, the human body itself must have served as a rich source of musical sound. Despite the non-African's conception of African music in terms of drums, historian John Storm Roberts has pointed out, the African instruments most often used by the greatest number of people in the greatest variety of societies are the human voice and the human hands used for clapping. Both approaches to music, one that reached out and found it in the external world, the second that drew it from the physiological characteristics of the human form, came with the African to America. In the 1930s, researchers working for the Federal Writers Project undertook a comprehensive program of recording the memoirs of former slaves. This collection, housed today at the Archive of Folk Song at the Library of Congress, provides telling insight into this distinctive African-American ability, strikingly similar to native African practices, to extract music from the detritus of day-to-day life. "There wasn't no music instruments," reads the oral history of former slave Wash Wilson. "Drums were fashioned out of a variety of discarded items. Pieces of sheep's rib or cow's jaw or a piece of iron with an old kettle or a hollow gourd and some horsehairs. Sometimes they'd get a piece of tree trunk and hollow it out and stretch a goat's or sheepskin over it for the drum. They'd be 1 to 4 foot high and a foot up to 6 foot across. They take the buffalo horn and scrape it out to make the flute. That shall be heard a long ways off. Then they take a mule's jawbone and rattle the stick across its teeth. They take a barrel and stretch an ox's hide across one end, and a man sat astride the barrel and beat on that hide with his hands and his feet. And if he got to feel the music in his bones, he'd beat on that barrel with his head. Another man beat on wooden sides with sticks." This ingenuity in creating percussion instruments was accompanied by a corresponding richness of rhythmic impulses. In African music, in both its original and its various Americanized forms, different pulses are frequently superimposed, creating powerful polyrhythms that are perhaps the most striking and characteristic aspect of these traditions. In the same way that Bach might intermingle different but interrelated melodies in creating a fugue, an African ensemble would construct layer upon layer of rhythmic patterns, forging a counterpoint of implied time signatures, a polyphony of percussion. We will encounter this multiplicity of rhythms again and again in our study of African-American music, from the lilting syncopations of ragtime to the diverse offbeat accents of the bebop drummer, to the jarring cross-rhythms of the jazz avant-garde. Theorists of rhythm often dwell on its liberating and Dionysian element, but the history of rhythm as a source of social control and power has yet to be written. The historian Johann Huizenga hypothesized that the introduction of drums into the ranks of soldiers marked the end of the feudal age of chivalry and signaled the beginning of modern warfare, with its coordinated regiments and precise military discipline. Perhaps the unobtrusive and steady rhythms of modern office music, and is not Muzak the work song of our own age, serve today to exert a subtle control over the white-collar worker of post-industrialized society. In any event, both aspects of rhythm, on the one hand as a source of liberation and on the other as a force of discipline and control, make their presence felt in African-American music. The work song was the melody of disciplined labor, and even here its source could be traced back to Africa. The African tradition, like the European peasant tradition, stressed hard work and derided laziness in any form, writes historian Eugene D. Genovese in his seminal study of slave society, Roll, Jordan, Roll. The celebration of labor inherent in the African-American work song must otherwise seem strangely out of place, coming from an oppressed race consigned to the indignities of slavery. But as soon as one sees the song of work as part of an inherently African approach to day-to-day life, one that integrates music into the occupations of here and now, this paradox disappears entirely. If the work song reflects rhythm as a source of discipline, the blues represents the other side of African rhythms, the Dionysian side that offered release. More than any of the other forms of early African-American music, the blues allowed the performer to present an individual statement of pain, oppression, poverty, longing, and desire. Yet it achieved all this without falling into self-pity and recriminations. Instead, the blues offered a catharsis, an idealization of the individual's plight and, in some strange way, an uplifting sense of mastery over the dire circumstances typically recounted in the context of these songs. In this regard, the blues offers us a psychological enigma as profound as any posed by classical tragedy. How art finds fulfillment for both artist and audience by dwelling on the oppressive and the tragic has been an issue for speculation at least since the time of Aristotle. Simply substitute the word blues for tragedy in most of these discussions, and we find ourselves addressing the same questions, only now in the context of African-American music. Country blues and classic blues. Long before the blues became recognized as a distinct style of music, it lived a subterranean existence in African-American communities. The blues would not emerge as a major force in the recording industry until the 1920s, but persistent scholars have uncovered earlier traces and hints of the music throughout the former slave states going back to the 19th century, especially in geographic settings with a high proportion of black sharecroppers and farm workers. Unlike jazz, which first came to the fore in New Orleans and flourished in other large cities, early blues found its most fertile breeding ground in rural areas and the most impoverished parts of the country. This humble lineage is all the more ironic when one considers how much the financial well-being of the later entertainment industry in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, London, and elsewhere would depend on this rustic music and its many offshoots in rock, R&B, funk, and other assorted urban genres. Blues songs began appearing in sheet music form as early as 1912, none with more staying power than W.C. Handy's St. Louis Blues, 1914, which would rank as the second most recorded song of the first half of the 20th century, surpassed only by Silent Night. The term blues, often misused to refer to any sad or mournful tune, is more properly linked, as we see in Handy's composition, to a precise structure that has come to be known as blues form. This repeating 12-bar pattern is typically built on three chords, tonic, dominant, and subdominant, and would later serve as the foundation for countless jazz and popular songs, as well as take on a second life in the 1950s as a widely used recipe for rock and roll and R&B music. When sung, as it usually was in its earliest variants, the blues also employs a specific stanza form for its lyrics in which an initial line is stated, repeated, and then followed with a rhyming line. For example, Handy's St. Louis Blues begins, "I hate to see that evening sun go down. I hate to see that evening sun go down. 'Cause my baby, he done left this town." Yet this type of lyric and chord pattern are not sufficient to convey the essence of the blues. The most characteristic component of this music is found in its distinctive melodic lines, which emphasize the so-called blue notes, often described as the use of both a major and minor third in the vocal line, along with a flatted seventh. The flatted fifth was a later addition, but would in time become equally prominent as a blue note. In truth, this stock description is also somewhat misleading. In early blues, the major and minor thirds were not used interchangeably. Instead, the musician might employ a bent note that would slide between these two tonal centers, or create a tension by emphasizing the minor third in a context in which the harmony implied a major tone. Sometimes this effect was achieved by means of a melismatic shift in the voice of the blues singer, but even instrumentalists made use of this approach, most strikingly in the slide guitar techniques that relied on moving a bottle, knife, or other object across the fretboard to stretch the individual pitches. After the arrival of the blues, notes were no longer just notes, but flexible sounds that could change in ways unforeseen by the most renowned 19th century composers. Much speculation has been offered as to the historical origin of this powerful and unique melodic device. Some commentators, for example, have suggested that this tonal ambiguity originated when the newly arrived slaves tried to reconcile an African pentatonic scale with a Western diatonic scale. This musical mashup resulted in two areas of oral potency, situated around the third and seventh intervals, sounds that evolved into the modern blue notes. In any event, this effect, which is impossible to convey in traditional notation, is one of the most gut-wrenching ingredients in 20th century music. Given its visceral impact, This approach to singing and instrumental performance inevitably spread beyond the blues idiom into jazz and a host of other commercial performance styles. The most traditional style of blues typically relies on just a vocal line with guitar accompaniment. Handy was inspired by just such a performance back in the Mississippi Delta when he heard a raggedy musician playing a guitar with a knife at a train station in Tutwiler, circa 1903. But this minimalist style of performance, often referred to as country blues, was slow in finding its way onto recordings. Not until the late 1920s, with the commercial success of Blind Lemon Jefferson, would this music demonstrate its clout in the marketplace. Jefferson, born near Wortham, Texas, in the closing years of the 19th century, employed a spare, riff-oriented guitar style behind his droning and resonant vocalizing. Although he was capable of raspy low tones, his voice was perhaps most admired for its thin high tones, a stylistic device that, for many listeners, stands out as the most distinctive characteristic of the early Texas blues sound. Jefferson recorded around 100 tracks for the Paramount label from 1926 through 1929, and his performances of songs such as Long Lonesome Blues, Matchbox Blues, and See That My Grave Is Kept Clean continue to delight fans today. Despite the efforts of various researchers, this artist's life remains clouded in mystery, and even the circumstances of his death are a matter of contentious speculation. Yet Jefferson appears to have traveled and performed widely before his demise in December 1929, and his fame and example paved the way for many later traditional blues artists. Paramount was anxious to build upon this success and brought two now legendary Mississippi blues artists to their recording studio in Grafton, Wisconsin, with hopes of making them into stars as well. Charlie Patton's powerful vocals and free-flowing guitar work captured the raw energy of the Delta tradition, but were combined with a slick showmanship that revealed how easily this often dark and introspective music could take on the trappings of commercial entertainment. Long before Jimi Hendrix and Stevie Ray Vaughan rose to fame on similar exhibitionist antics, Patton would play the guitar behind his back or between his legs, spin it round, or slap it like a drum. His Pony Blues, recorded in June 1929, was a hit for Paramount, and at a follow-up session for the label, Patton brought along Eddie Son House, recently released from Parchman Prison, who would later inspire many important blues artists, most notably Robert Johnson and Muddy Waters. House's music was more foreboding than Patton's, and at times almost apocalyptic in tone. His performances on recordings such as Preachin' the Blues and Dry Spell Blues, with their quasi-biblical language and stark guitar accompaniment, may not have sold well at the time, but they eventually contributed to the now pervasive image of the Delta blues as a haunting music sung by troubled souls. This mythology of the blues as the music of salvation and damnation reached its highest pitch in the figure of Robert Johnson. Even people who know little about blues music have usually heard the story of Johnson selling his soul to the devil at midnight at a crossroads in exchange for a preternatural ability to play the guitar. In recent years, blues scholars such as Elijah Wald, Barry Lee Pearson, and Bill McCullough have tried to defuse this legend as an embarrassing example of the mythologizing tendency of overly zealous fans. Yet one cannot excuse Johnson himself of complicity in the diffusion of this oft-told tale. Some of his best-known recordings, such as Hellhound on My Trail, Crossroad Blues, or Me and the Devil Blues, helped propel the attention-getting rumor, although this artist also left behind songs dealing with other time-honored blues themes, romantic love and its more carnal manifestations, revelries, infidelities, and especially rambling and life on the road. Johnson's travels started soon after he was born, the 11th child of Julia Major Dodds, probably on May 8, 1911. As an infant, he lived in various migrant labor camps with his mother and sister Carrie, or in Memphis under the same roof as Julia's husband, Charles Dodds, or with her later spouse, Dusty Willis, back in the Delta. When he started performing as a guitarist, Johnson wandered even farther, throughout Mississippi and around the South and up north as far as Canada, if various accounts can be believed. He may have used a half dozen or more aliases in these various settings, further complicating the task of any biographer, but adding to the mystique of an artist who often seemed on the run rather than merely on the road. But of the power of his music, as documented at two sessions in 1936 and 1937, there can be no dispute. More than any other artist, Robert Johnson codified the disparate strains of the blues guitar tradition into a coherent musical vision that could be assimilated and adapted by the broader stream of American popular music. Johnson had listened widely, not just to other guitarists in the Delta, but also to many recordings of artists from other parts of the country, and learned deeply, mastering a host of techniques later imitated by generations of followers: turnarounds, passing chords, boogie patterns, fills, vamps, licks, and the like. Moreover, Johnson forged these building blocks into compositions that sounded more like crafted tunes than the hand-me-down blues favored by so many of his predecessors and contemporaries, as testified to by the success of frequently covered Johnson songs such as "Come On In My Kitchen," "Sweet Home Chicago," and "I Believe I'll Dust My Broom." Less often noted, but equally important to the success of this artist, was the intimacy and flexibility of his voice. Johnson was known to use his singing to seduce women, and apparently some of that seductive power lingers on in recordings that have found a surprising crossover audience. Not only have rock icons such as the Rolling Stones and Eric Clapton turned to Robert Johnson for inspiration, but their fans have also followed suit, so much so that the Complete Recordings, issued in 1990, which label execs only expected to sell a few tens of thousands of copies, eventually found an audience of millions. Johnson, for his part, never lived to enjoy the rewards of this success. He died on August 13, 1938, at age 27, apparently poisoned by a jealous husband. Many scholars have tried to link the blues convention of a singer accompanied by solo guitar back to earlier African traditions, envisioning the blues as a New World continuation of the West African performance practices associated with the griot, the musical bards of their oral societies. Certainly some similarities can be seen in the two musical idioms. For example, the stringed accompaniment of the kora, a West African harp lute characteristic of griot music, is somewhat reminiscent of the role of the guitar in early blues styles, especially in the use of the plucked string to continue and comment on the melody line of the singer. However, in traditional West African society, the griot's songs figured not as an outpouring of personal expression, something that is so essential to the blues, but as a way of preserving historical and folkloric stories for the larger tribal unit. Hence, in terms of function, the griot is perhaps closer to the singing bards who helped shape epic poetry in Western cultures than to a Robert Johnson or Charlie Patton, whose recorded performances reflect distinctly individualistic perspectives on the subjects addressed in their songs. Blues expert Samuel Charters undertook field research in West Africa in 1974, where he tried to document the connections between these musical currents of two continents, while other scholars have proposed linkages between American blues and the bardic tradition of East Africa, or the music of Yoruban priests, or even the Islamic call to prayer. Despite these efforts, many key aspects of blues music, its distinctive bent thirds, its chord patterns, and its heady mixture of bravado and alienation, resist reduction into African antecedents. As Charters himself eventually concluded, things in the blues had come from the tribal musicians of the old kingdoms, but as a style, the blues represented something else. It was essentially a new kind of song that had begun with a new life in the American South. If the country blues tradition, with its emphasis on a solo singer, usually male, accompanying himself on guitar, shows the closest ties to these African precedents, a more acculturated variant of this music, relying primarily on female vocalists, would exert greater influence on early jazz. The songs of the great women blues singers of the 1920s and 1930s, sometimes referred to as classic blues, would find a commercial market several years before Blind Lemon Jefferson or Charlie Patton made their first recordings. While the country blues singer would take liberties with the bar lines, the classic blues vocalist would strictly follow the 12-bar form. While the Delta blues player would accompany himself on guitar, the classic blues singer would typically front a band. The classic blues came to draw more readily and obviously on other forms of music, from Tin Pan Alley and the jazz world, with many musicians performing in both the blues and jazz genres, as well as from minstrel shows, circuses, vaudeville, and other sources of traveling music in the South. As part of this process, the structural underpinnings of the music, arrangements, solos, introductions, the use of call and response became more formulaic and thus more easy for outsiders to assimilate. Still, other aspects of the blues were transformed under the influence of the classic blues singers. As Sandra Lee, biographer of Ma Rainey, explains, the classic blues revealed a specifically female awareness, especially about the nature of love. Unrequited love, salacious love, abused love. These now emerged even more prominently as central aspects of the blues ethos, both amplifying and sometimes countering the more general spirit of alienation, loneliness, and desolation that permeated the country blues idiom. At the same time, blues performance was now moving from the happenstance surroundings of the street corner, train station, and juke house to formally designated locations, including theaters, tents, barns, and assembly halls, where paying customers came specifically seeking name acts and their well-known songs. In essence, the blues had evolved from a folk art to a form of mass entertainment. This transformation was fueled in part by a tremendous growth in the market for blues recordings by black female vocalists. In 1920, the General Phonograph Company achieved an unprecedented hit with a recording of Crazy Blues sung by Mamie Smith. In its first month of release, Smith's debut sold 75,000 copies, and within a year, sales had surpassed 1 million. This surprising success prompted several other companies to enter this nascent market. One of the phonograph companies made over $4 million on the blues, a writer proclaimed in Metronome magazine. Now every phonograph company has a colored girl recording. The Race Records, as these releases were labeled, encompassed a wide range of black musical forms, with both secular and religious material finding an enthusiastic audience. In 1926 alone, more than 300 blues and gospel recordings were released in the United States, most of them featuring African-American women vocalists. Priced at 50 or 75 cents, these records sold well, and by the following year the number of releases increased to 500. To meet the growing demand, companies sent talent scouts on field trips to find and record promising black musicians. No fewer than 17 field trips, for example, were made by record industry representatives to Atlanta during the late 1920s, while Memphis, Dallas, and New Orleans were also frequent stopping points for these song-seeking expeditions. Gertrude Ma Rainey, who was born in Columbus, Georgia on April 26, 1886, typified the first generation of blues divas. Together with her husband Will, or Pa Rainey, as he was sometimes called, this immensely popular artist toured the South as part of a traveling minstrel show. She recorded extensively in the mid-1920s, and her throbbing contralto voice graced over 100 records during a 5-year period. In stark contrast to the country blues singers, who usually accompanied themselves, Rainey recorded with some of the finest jazz musicians of her day, including Louis Armstrong and Coleman Hawkins. Her career also reflected the sharp difference between the informal blues stylings of the Delta and other rural areas, and the polished stage presentations that marked the classic blues as commercial fare for a mass audience. The Delta musician often traveled with little more than a guitar in hand. In contrast, Rainey brought four trunks of props, backdrops, lighting, and other show business trappings, as well as a lavish array of costumes and fashion accessories. Rainey's performances served to entertain, indeed to dazzle. They incorporated humor as a characteristic element, and they revealed a more overt connection to the popular music, minstrel shows, and jazz of the day. But a deep artistry coexisted with the theatrical aspects of Rainey's work. In a piece such as Yonder Come the Blues, recorded in 1926, the virtues of her singing are readily apparent. Her straightforward, declarative manner of presenting a lyric, her succulent held notes, which hang in the air like ripe fruit from the tree, and her sure sense of time, which propels the rest of the band. Rainey's recordings span a scant half-decade. Like many musicians of her generation, Rainey's career was irreparably hurt by the barren economic prospects of the 1930s. In 1935, Rainey retired from performing and returned to her native Georgia, where she became active in the Baptist Church. She died in Rome, Georgia on December 22, 1939. Bessie Smith, a protege of Rainey's, stands out as the greatest of the classic blues singers. Born in Chattanooga, Tennessee, probably on April 15, 1894, although the 1900 census gives an 1892 date, Smith began singing and dancing on street corners for spare change around the age of 9. In her mid-teens, Smith went on the road as a member of Ma Rainey's touring show, and though Rainey had often been credited as a mentor and teacher to the young singer, the exact extent of this education is a matter of conjecture. Smith's deeply resonant voice was probably evident from the start and may have been the key factor in getting her the job with the Rainey troupe. On the other hand, Rainey's skills as a performer, as well as her mastery of the blues repertoire, must have been an inspiration to this teenage newcomer to the world of traveling shows. Smith soon came to surpass her teacher in the variety of her melodic inventions, her impressive pitch control, and the expressive depth of her music. Inevitably, the younger vocalist decided to leave Rainey to further her own career and was initially employed as a singer for Milton Starr's theater circuit, the infamous TOBA, which stood ostensibly for Theater Owners Booking Agency, but which was often referred to by black performers with grim humor as tough on black artists, or sometimes as tough on black asses. In Smith's case, the caustic acronym was well-deserved. As a TOBA artist, she joined Pete Worley's minstrel show, where her pay, at least initially, was as little as $2.50 per week. However, in 1923, Smith's recording Downhearted Blues boosted her to widespread fame. The record reportedly sold over a 500,000 in copies in a few months, and soon Smith was recording regularly and performing for as much as $2,000 per week. She toured extensively, entertaining capacity audiences in large venues, tents set up on the outskirts of town as well as in downtown theaters, in the South and along the eastern seaboard. Smith, like the blues itself, had risen from the streets to the most spacious performance halls, a setting for which her talents were admirably suited. Her powerful voice could reach to the back row of the largest theater without the need for amplification, and her sure skills as a comedian and entertainer, as well as her dominating stage presence, enabled Smith to captivate audiences who would have been put off by the troubled, introspective blues of a Robert Johnson or Son House. The poignant aspects of the blues here became tempered with humor and the use of sexual double entendre. Songs such as Empty Bed Blues, Need a Little Sugar in My Bowl, You've Got to Give Me Some, and Kitchen Man expounded on, with varying degrees of subtlety, the subject of copulation. This openness to sexual themes helped, on the one hand, to sell records, while, on the other, it led to the condemnation of Smith in particular and the blues in general among many social and religious groups, including much of the black middle class. Although Smith played a prominent role in the merging of blues and popular music, her ambitions could hardly have been realized without the complementary efforts of a host of songwriters, publishers, musicians, and record producers. This evolutionary process, still making its impact felt today, exerted an especially transformative influence on American music in the years between 1910 and 1930. Even before the first blues recordings were made, the blues idiom began filtering into the mainstream of American parlor sheet music under the influence of Tin Pan Alley songwriters such as W.C. Handy. Alabama-born Handy drew on his experiences as a bandleader in Mississippi and his early apprenticeship with a touring minstrel troupe in his visionary efforts to expand the vocabulary of American popular song. His success in this regard is amply documented in milestone compositions such as Memphis Blues, 1912, St. Louis Blues, 1914, and Beale Street Blues, 1916. Although his fame as Father of the Blues, as some have designated this composer, is an overstatement, Handy's impact as an innovator and popularizer of this new genre justifies his prominent place in the annals of American music. After moving to New York in 1917, Handy was well-positioned to champion African-American popular music, not only as a performer and songwriter, but also as a music publisher and owner of a record company. Many of the songs written by Handy and other blues-influenced songwriters became core components of Smith's repertoire, a mutually beneficial collaboration in which Smith tapped the songwriting skills of the New York professionals and in which Tin Pan Alley profited in turn from the power and authenticity of Smith's interpretations. At the same time, Smith's work betrayed strong jazz ties, as demonstrated by her recordings with Louis Armstrong, Benny Goodman, Coleman Hawkins, James P. Johnson, Jack Teagarden, Fletcher Henderson, and others. These various links characterized an important evolution in the blues, from the idiosyncratic music of the Mississippi Delta to the syncretic music of the recording studios. This ability to evolve in tandem with changes in other spheres of popular music would continue to characterize the blues in ensuing decades. Yet the blues has also retained a primal core that has resisted assimilation and change. When we listen to Smith in her 1925 collaborations with Armstrong on St. Louis Blues and Reckless Blues, we can already hear the different aesthetic sensibilities that, even at this early date, were beginning to distinguish the jazz and blues idioms. Armstrong favors ornamentation and elaboration. Smith tends toward unadorned emotional directness. In contrast to Armstrong's Baroque accompaniment, Smith's singing is built around drawn-out tones, sometimes bellowed with authority, occasionally betraying a tremulous vulnerability. Smith preferred languorous tempos, while jazz music of this period increasingly relied on faster, dance-oriented rhythms. On St. Louis Blues, the tempo lingers around